This is Spotify, a product story, and I'm your host, Gustav Söderström. I head up product engineering, data, and design for Spotify. In this podcast, we bring you the stories behind the biggest product strategy lessons that we've learned at Spotify, all told in the words of the people who were actually there, who lived it, and who made it happen. Today, we're going to tell the story of Backstage, a platform of platforms, built by Spotify and open to anyone. Back in 2016, Spotify was growing like crazy. For the last several years, we've been doubling in size. And when you're growing that fast, sometimes you can't even keep up with yourself.
When I joined Spotify, I had this image of Spotify as being so fast and like top of their game. And I was kind of like disappointed in like how messy everything was and how extremely confusing everything was. And like normal things, like knowing which API to implement or integrate towards.
This is Pia Nilsson, Director of Engineering at Spotify. When Pia started working on the platform team, that's what we call Spotify's technology infrastructure team, she immediately saw that while things may have looked buttoned up and professional on the outside, on the inside, it was a very different story. Like many startups, we had outgrown the ways to share knowledge that worked so well when we were a much smaller company. But we'd failed to replace them with anything new. And it was having serious, measurable effects on productivity, especially for new engineering hires.
So we in Platform, where I worked, we were measuring productivity. And we were using many metrics for that, but the most telling one was our onboarding metric. So that's measuring the time it takes for an engineer to merge their 10th pull request. And as we were hiring really successfully and growing rapidly in number of employees, we could see the onboarding metric was actually going the wrong direction and fast. So one could say we had this stark realization that we were hiring like crazy and becoming slower.
So we were speeding up, but at the same time slowing down.
Yeah.
So at best, net zero.
Exactly, or even worse. So we had an onboarding time of 60 days for engineers, which was increasing.
Wow. Did you have a sense back then when you looked at that and said 60 days, what was your feeling? Was it like, maybe that's okay? Or was it like, that seems super long?
Yeah, so I was like, having spent 15 years as an engineer at other companies, it was like a cold shower.
So it took our engineers upwards of 60 days to contribute or commit useful code to Spotify. That meant that for their first 2 months on the job, they weren't able to make meaningful contributions to Spotify's product, which was frustrating for everyone. Even worse, the more people we hired, the longer the onboarding took. The first step to figuring out a solution? Pinpointing exactly what was getting in their way. And to do that, Pia and her team approached this internal product development, what used to be called IT or infrastructure, like any other consumer-facing product development. Beginning with a vital part of the process that often gets left off the table with a typical top-down platform mindset, user research.
This was new to us. We had very technical product managers who didn't do much user research. However, we had a bunch of really strong product managers who were teaching the whole platform organization that we need to think about the humans instead of thinking about the technology. So this is obvious for anyone who's building products usually, but not for a platform organization. We kind of focus on tech and think if we build it, great, everyone will love it, which actually isn't the case all the time. So we went out there into the different business units, asking our engineers, like, what is blocking you? Why are we so slow in onboarding people? And two things came up constantly. The number one winner blocker was interruptions. People are interrupted constantly. The context switching. So why are we context switching all the time? Well, it has to do with the growth. So the growth of Spotify had resulted in one team becoming two teams, becoming three teams. So people were moving along and filling the gaps as they were created. That meant that the new joiners who were hired to evolve a product that was already built had to tap someone on the shoulder, because very seldom there was any documentation left for these people who had to really quickly ramp up to build the next new library, basically. And the second thing that popped up as the number two problem was that people couldn't find things. It was simple as that. It took forever to just find the right service, actually, to even integrate with, because there were so many almost duplications, not pure duplications, because people are very smart and they would recognize that, obviously. But if you are in a premium team and you need user data, you quickly build your user data service for your needs. And then if you are the customer service team and you need some user data, so you're going to build a little service, or are you going to look for 2 weeks to find the premium user data service? No. So there were like at least 15 different versions speaking to slightly different needs for the same kind of service. So finding the right service to use, or building your own, the documentations, reading the updated documentations even, that was the second biggest problem. So we realized, okay, we need one central place. So this is like an obvious realization, right? We need one central place for everything, where people can go and market their service to their internal customers, and where people can go find everything. Now, the problem with that simple idea, as many companies before us have realized, is that a central team will always be way slower than the very fast-moving business units out there.
Why didn't you do the obvious thing of just doing the platform requirements list? The traditional solution would have been, you go to me or to Daniel and you get the mandate to own all architecture. And then the platform org says, this is how it's going to be done. Here's a requirements list. Everyone prioritize the requirements and we're going to do them one by one. And so you have perfect synchrony. And it sounds like what you just said is instead, no, that's not going to work. That's bottlenecking all productivity. How did you come to those product insights?
So we basically knew we couldn't build a centralized solution. It would never work. No one would use it. We didn't have the mandate. We could never find the mandate or get the mandate. And no one really believed in it, even among ourselves, because that's why we had joined Spotify for the reason. One of the reasons were that we all loved autonomy. We thought that was like brilliant to set people free. So we didn't want to be that boring platform team. I think that, so the culture really spoke to us there, like, well, you don't have the option of building something central and mandating everyone.
That's very interesting. So you're basically saying the autonomy that was part of the problem of creating this fragmentation, It was also the thing that forced you to find a different solution, because the autonomy was so deeply rooted that there really wasn't an option to just say everyone needs to do it this way. That wasn't sort of accepted. You needed to find a solution that could work within the autonomy.
Yeah. It was a market economy inside of Spotify. We had to be better than whatever the feature teams could build themselves if they are going to use us. It was up to them.
Thanks to Pia and her team, we knew what we needed. A user-friendly, company-wide repository, a place where anyone can find everything, but nobody has to use anything. But we didn't know where we could find such a tool. Because although many, many companies struggle with these exact same issues, there simply was no off-the-shelf solution designed for a company of our size. And even if there were, unless it was 10 times better than the systems that individual teams had custom-made to suit their hyper-specific use cases, we were never going to get them to adopt it, because of Spotify's autonomy-oriented culture. So for whatever solution we built to even have a chance of succeeding, it had to prove itself, just like products out in the real world. And there's a lesson there. Lesson number one: engineers are users too. All the usual product principles still apply. You're never going to get traction if you try to force people to use a product that doesn't actually solve their problems. don't use the fact that you're building internally and happen to have a monopoly on your users as an excuse not to do the work. But even though we apply the same product development principles that we've explored throughout this show, actually pulling it off was much more challenging than you might expect. It was certainly more challenging than we expected. Not only was the documentation lacking, and the service integrations fragmented and duplicative, but the sheer amount of code was staggering.
So if you'd printed out all this code and stacked it up on, you know, 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper, it basically would have nearly cleared the top of the World Trade Center.
That's Tyson Singer, Spotify's head of technology and platforms. And he told me that that code wasn't just gargantuan, it was practically indecipherable.
The first time I saw some of the code that supported our A-B testing that was in our mobile clients, I honestly didn't even think it was code. I was like, what is this? I don't understand what's going on. So there was, yeah, there was quite a few challenges inside of that code base.
This was lovingly referred to as the spaghetti code.
Yeah, absolutely. Spaghetti code. And what was interesting then is that, you know, for a lot of people, they were like, what's the problem? Because you have these people who knew the code inside out. They were multi-language gurus. They could move between the iOS ecosystem and the C++ ecosystem, and they could debug it. And then you had just a lot of people who were in that like WTF group. They're like, I don't know how to do anything. And so all I'm going to do is I'm going to cut and paste something which I know works, and I'm going to plop it down, and I'm going to get my feature done and move on. So that was one of those things which I wasn't expecting when I joined Spotify, because I had, you know, heard more about the back end and the server infrastructure, which was just state of the art. Like basically Spotify had built out a microservices architecture and scaled it out to thousands of services effectively. And so we had this really solid infrastructure there, but we didn't have much of a data strategy. And when I took the role that I currently had, I kind of walked right into the middle of the battle between the decentralists and the centralists, basically the data anarchists and the data
communists,
controllers. Data communists, yes, exactly. And it did take a while for us to actually go forward and try to resolve this conflict.
So we faced what looked like many different problems, including this philosophical difference in how to organize data. But they turned out to actually share one relatively simple solution. The solution was, of course, the developer portal we now call Backstage. And for such an intuitive idea, it's surprisingly hard to put Backstage into words. Tyson likes to call it an app store with an attitude, in that Backstage makes it easy to find all the different apps that you would want as a developer to do your job. But it's got an attitude in that it's opinionated, and it's designed to guide you into certain best practices, like our golden paths.
These are like our blessed ways of doing things. And those golden paths are part tutorial, but they're also templates. So now I'm here and I need to create a new backend service. I need to create a new mobile feature. I go into Backstage and I click a button and I say, boom, create me the golden one. One that's based off all of the latest and best technology patterns at Spotify that everybody else at Spotify will know. And poof, it's there. So that's part of the value statement for an employee, especially if they're one of these employees who is moving into an engineering discipline that's not as familiar with them. They don't have to know maybe all the details of how to, you know, set up a Kubernetes cluster and manage all that sort of stuff.
Pia, on the other hand, says Backstage is like a mall. The services that had previously been scattered all over Spotify's infrastructure are the stores. In the past, you had to make a special trip to each store to get what you needed. But now, even though they're still operating autonomously, all the stores are under the same roof. So you can stroll from one to the next, picking up whatever strikes your eye along the way. What these two analogies have in common is that they're both turning the problem into a marketplace. By visualizing these microservices and data sets using plugins, and then putting an economy on top of it, people are empowered to make their own choices. And that's lesson number two. You can't have autonomy without an economy. Solve your internal problems by putting an economy on top of them, instead of mandating them away. What we found is that there are two ways to create unified single solutions. One is basically through communism, central top-down planning. And the other is capitalism. By treating Backstage like a marketplace, where you can pick and choose the services that are most relevant to you, trusting that the strongest ideas and integrations rise to the top, you still get unification. And everyone who participates has opted in because these really are the best tools for the job. It's voluntary unification instead of mandated unification. But you know what you need when you have a marketplace? Marketing. So with Backstage, we did our user research to make sure it wasn't just good in theory. And then we made it as beautiful and easy to use as any of our consumer-facing products, complete with an elegant user interface and proper documentation. We even hired a marketing team to get the word out, internally.
So what was the thinking behind taking the consumer approach, even though you're basically a monopolist internally? And why don't you think other platform orgs necessarily think like that?
Yeah, so I wish I were a monopolist. It would have been so much easier. But the reality of our culture at Spotify is I can rarely pull that card of being a monopolist. We have it and we use it primarily for migrations. And you know, we try to keep those to a minimum. But for the most part, if we go out and we tell people do X, they just shrug and they do whatever the hell they want. So we really do have to sell to them. We have to basically make their lives better with everything that we do. And so it really did inform, through necessity to some degree, our approach if we wanted to take control of this fragmentation problem in our tech ecosystem. We couldn't just do that and really get away with it.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting observation, that the autonomy in Spotify basically allowed people to kind of use whatever solution they wanted. And we encouraged that, which can create enormous complexity globally when everyone runs different solutions. So there was this more Darwinian environment where, because of our culture, it was actually very hard to mandate solutions, and you kind of have to compete by creating good solutions.
Yeah. So we created good solutions. We created the golden pass to make things easy and fast. We invested a lot in education and opinionated education, which is like, okay, you join Spotify. Here's the right way to do things. Here's the fast way to do things. And then ongoing education. And people love our educational programs internally. They get really, really fantastic feedback. And so we had to do all those things. We had to invest in a marketing department, which I don't think is very typical for an internal infrastructure organization at the normal company to actually invest in marketing. And we got a very good marketing department, and it was sort of very effective in how we had to message out at scale to all of our employees.
Yeah, I think some people raised some eyebrows saying like, wait, marketing department, who are you going to market to? You have no customers, right?
Yes. So it was certainly challenging at times to justify some of these investments because they look non-intuitive. And so just the ability of the team to sell that vision. And I didn't do it myself entirely. We had some fantastic folks who are out there just like aligning and selling folks to get to this outcome where we now have this consistency of a user experience is something I'm proud of, because it's so easy to resort to the dictates and the heavy arm twisting and to basically leave our independent and autonomous spirit intact and explain really the rationale and the why of why we're going in this direction and get people on board because of that. So that's, I think, it's nice not to sort of lose the core spirit of your culture when you're really pushing hard for a particular outcome.
After Backstage officially launched in late 2017, it slowly but surely won over even Spotify's most discerning engineers. Even better, as it became more and more widely adopted, we finally saw those scary onboarding metrics starting to decrease. From 60 days down to 50 days, from 50 days down to 40 days. And for the last year, we've averaged just 20 days between an engineer's first day on the job and their 10th pull request. A couple of years after we launched Backstage within Spotify, we set up a series of informal conversations to compare notes with other tech companies like Netflix, Twitter, and Google to see what we could learn from each other. And during those conversations, we realized that because we had treated it like a regular product, Backstage was suitable for more than just our particular challenges and goals. On a fundamental level, Backstage was flexible enough to serve virtually any company's needs, unlike many other internal platform products. And that's when we seriously started to consider open sourcing it. When we were building Backstage, we had never even considered taking it open source. So we started by asking ourselves a series of questions.
One, is it something that is proprietary for our core business or not?
Nope. Although many companies can benefit from Backstage, it isn't going to make us or our competitors much better at being an audio company specifically.
Two is, will it drive a substantial impact on our tech brand and drive that goodwill in the community that we want associated with our technology brand?
Yes. Releasing Backstage would show the tech world the kind of innovative products we're building behind the scenes. And new hires could already be familiar with the workflow, making onboarding even quicker.
Three, is it something where there's a lot of benefit to sharing the development costs and creating an ecosystem where that innovation can feed back into it?
Yes. Making Backstage's source code freely available will let anyone add their own plugins to the marketplace. Plugins that everyone, including us, could use. We were effectively opening up our engineering team to contributions from the entire world.
And then finally, is it something that can create a new industry standard and help us mitigate the cost of ongoing migrations and how central and important that is?
Yes. If Backstage were as useful to everyone else as we hoped it would be, it could potentially be adopted industry-wide, which would mean we wouldn't need to switch it out later on when someone else inevitably set a new standard for solving this problem, avoiding the type of very expensive migration that we face when we move to the cloud in episode 5. And so, in February 2020, we went all in and released Backstage into the world as an open source product. This was the real test. Now freely available to the public, Backstage actually was a consumer product, and it had to perform like one. Jeremiah Lowen thinks a lot about what it means to open source a project. His company, Prefect, runs on what's called an open core model, which means that Prefect's source code is free. What Prefect's clients pay for are additional services on top of the source code itself. They're effectively paying for convenience, just like Spotify's earliest subscribers did. And for Jeremiah, it was the little things about Backstage that immediately made an impression. Specifically, one little thing.
The thing that told me that this was a very interesting project was actually not how many people were using it or anything like that. It was the fact that I think there was an animated logo in the docs.
The logo Jeremiah is talking about is a cheery little GIF that lives about halfway down Backstage's homepage. It's a super simple image, one big circle with three smaller circles orbiting it. It either looks like a planet with three moons, or a nucleus circled by three electrons, depending on who you ask.
So this animated logo that I'm so fixated on, I think is representative of a larger idea, which is the maturity of Backstage at the time it was open sourced. And that said to me, as someone who is building an open source, a popular open source project, that said to me that there was a decision to put resources into the brand, the design, the outreach, and the feel of this. And I know that that is almost always a second order concern of the decision to open source something. Because first you have to prove that it's useful, and then you can try to make it something people want to be part of.
To Jeremiah, while that logo looks like a cute little GIF, what it represents is a level of craftsmanship and community that unfortunately many open source projects never receive. From the extensive user research to the internal marketing push to the dedicated team of engineers and designers that now run day-to-day operations for Backstage, it shows, all in that one logo.
I was astounded when I saw it. And I, for all I know, I don't even know if I had yet connected that it was from Spotify or not when I had this thought in my head. But I remember looking at it and thinking, this is the dream scenario for any young open source project, to have this response at its announcement and leave absolutely no question about whether it will be useful. And I know what are the signs that we look for. And some of them are this exponential uptake in interest and utility and a community. And Backstage had all of those things from day one, thanks to a variety of things. You just know that there's a path forward here. Is it a guarantee? Absolutely not. There are many strategic decisions and use cases and utilities that have to be delivered. There's a roadmap with many years long that has to be executed. It's not automatic, but it is so de-risked versus most nascent open source projects that it just seemed clear to me that there was going to be this extraordinary interest in promoting this project and taking it somewhere.
I think many people think of open source as just a thing, but if you think about it from a strategy point of view, what are some examples do you think where open source fits really well, for example, and where do they fit perhaps very poorly? Is it okay to generalize and say, for example, when you build consumer experiences, it tends to be very hard because they need to be opinion driven versus if you're building infrastructure, it works better, or if it's about trust or scalability, or when it's actually non-strategic, that's when you should open source. And when it's strategic, you should not open source. How do you think about this?
I think it's a fabulous question. I would suggest that all else equal, if the success of your software is in some way predicated on taking some significant risk, whether it's in design, strategy, approach, the way it works, the way it feels, open source will probably not be the best fit for it. Because open source, there's a feeling to open source about embracing a community view, a communal approach to discovery of use case and application of solution, which may not align well with the idea that if you're building, for example, a consumer product that has a wildly different way of working. On the other hand, when an application is intended to deliver a wide variety of use cases, then putting it into an open source context can be a very effective way to surface those use cases much more rapidly than a small team or potentially an opinionated team would be able to do on their own. Because the small team has to take on the challenge of not only contemplating the use case, but then instrumenting it, designing for it, and putting it into the application. Whereas in an open source context, frameworks, for example, are really great to open source because the community will communicate back whether or not it meets their expectations and needs for a series of use cases that the original designer may not have even been aware of. And products that depend on a very specific vision are more challenging to put in the open source because many of the advantages of the open source model are compromised by this laser focus on a potentially controversial vision.
What advice would you have to product strategists interested in leveraging open source as a tool?
I think it's very important to understand the true advantages and disadvantages of the open source model, in addition to the obvious ones that you can reach more people and that you have an automatic place to build a community. I think you really need to understand the effort it takes to drive that and understand what would you look at to know that this was a successful endeavor. In almost all other product decisions, we set up metrics. We set up ways to understand, were we successful? Did this work as we expected? Was it a positive ROI endeavor? And I think open source, again, there's this temptation to just open source something and sort of hope the model will work. Hope that it will just get picked up. And that has no place in a product strategy. There should be some understanding of, if this community takes off, what will that look like? How will we further that? There's no hope is never an investment strategy, and certainly not in this case.
And that is our final lesson for today. Hope is never an investment strategy. You can't simply build your product, release it out into the wild, and cross your fingers. Just like you would never think of putting your app up in the App Store hoping for the best. Many developers may hate to admit it, but you need to put at least as much effort into building the community around your product as you put into writing the actual code.
This is the most important thing of all. At the end of the day, it can be very disappointing to some engineers who open source projects to discover that it is not enough to just have great features. It's not enough to just have an interesting open source project. You must invest in building the ecosystem around it. Otherwise, to be honest, you're not taking advantage of the open source model to its fullest extent. And I think that this has become sort of a thing that everybody knows, but very, very, very few people seem willing to execute on. It's very hard to build a community. And if we can be honest, most engineers are uninterested in spending a majority of their time engaging with a community, because if we think about where most open source projects come from, they came from someone who had the time and energy and foresight to write code and get something into the world, not by someone who is primarily motivated by interacting with a group of people who want to use an already existing project. And so that transition can be very difficult to manage and takes a lot of real commitment.
At least so far, we've done the work. As of now, roughly a year after Backstage went open source, our platform of platforms is currently in use at DoorDash, American Airlines, Expedia, Roku, Wealthsimple, Fiverr, and many more. We've learned from experience that open sourcing isn't something you do once and walk away from. It's an ongoing, sustained commitment and effort. And just like internal product development, open source projects are often treated like an afterthought, instead of as a real product. But when you do fully commit to them, you can reap the strategic rewards. That's it for today's show. But before we wrap up, here's a quick rundown of the top three lessons from this episode. Lesson number one: engineers are users too. This should be obvious, but basic product principles like user research and design are too often overlooked when it comes to internal products. Lesson number two: you can't have autonomy without an economy. Solve your internal problems by putting an economy on top of them, instead of just trying to mandate them away. Lesson number three: hope is never an investment strategy. Ask yourself how you will make sure your product is a success, instead of just hoping that it will be. In our next and final episode of the season, you'll hear how we're shaking up podcasting from the bottom of the stack up.
Giving creators all of these different ways to get feedback from their audience is going to be really a game changer. Like, we're not necessarily just making podcasts anymore, we're making audio. And I think that's a whole new world of use cases and ways to express yourself that haven't really been possible before.
We think we're flattening the hierarchy between the host and the guest and creating situations that feel much more like roundtables for every sort of discussion, which is exciting for fans and exciting for hosts. And I think is creating a lot more hosts, a lot more organic hosts, a lot more people who never would have taken on the mantle of doing the work of leading a show or planning a show.
Spotify, A Product Story is produced by Munk Studios for Spotify. Special thanks to Stefan Åhlund, Thomas Lundboy, Ruspe Delavari, Kat Zoo, and Jonathan Dahl for helping us with the background research on Backstage. Veronica Harth is our in-house Spotify correspondent. We're edited by Francis Harlow and mixed by Joachim Löfgen, Victor Bergdahl, and Andrea Fantussi. Our theme music was composed by Andrea Fantussi. I'm Gustav Söderström. Thanks for listening.